Session number 1317, Rule 3.
Mr. Miles, Rule 3.
The torpedo's missed, obviously. But as I mentioned before, you're losing 9 ton in weight. So the submarine tends to come up unless you put on speed. This was the problem. In all the excitement that was going on at that particular time, I mean, what we've been trained for, a battleship of all things, and in the excitement, we forgot the speed up. And when I say we, I'd assume it that way. We forgot the speed up, so therefore there was no power on the hydroplanes, and we shot to the surface. And we were on the surface in the middle of the Italian fleet, where everybody could see us. Well, it's difficult to describe. There was no panic at all, but we knew that that was the end. You see, destroyers all around us. We expected to be rammed at any moment. Anyway, we flooded everything we'd got, all the tanks we flooded, and I suppose we were up about 30 seconds, I suppose. And then we went down like a stone. And I suppose that's what did it. Having got down, I felt safe. If you can understand that. We were safe from being rammed, but we knew we'd got it to come with depth charges, of course. So we were down. And we were so heavy then that we flooded everything we'd got, that we were going down like the proverbial outside lavatory. Womp, straight down. And I think it was that saved us, really, because overcame a destroyer and unloaded its depth charges, but I think they'd set them too shallow. And we were way down when they exploded. All right, they did damage, but they didn't obviously destroy us. They did damage. And I think on my depth gauge, we went down to 380 feet before we could even stop her. But one of the depth charges had hit us, and we've got to go back here again a bit. When the Regent was built, they found that it hadn't got sufficient buoyancy. So they built what we used to call a balloon tank. That was a tank outside the submarine in the casing, which gave us another 6 ton of buoyancy. And one of the depth charges burst that tank, you see. So we got 6 ton of water in there, which made us 6 ton heavy down below. And so we like that. And another one, unfortunately, burst a fuel tank, or an oil tank. Now, there's a clutch between the engine and the motor. You use the engines on the surface, and you use the motors when you're dived. So when you're dived, you unclutch the engine so that the motor can run without turning the engine. But it's an oil clutch. So this oil leaked in from the burst tank into the clutch and made the engine. In other words, when the motor was going, it was also turning the engine, which is a disaster. The noise and everything else. So we had to stop it. By this time, we were going half speed, both in a high degree. We were high power and low power. So we had to stop one where the engine was connected and go full speed on the other one. Well, we couldn't use pump. We couldn't pump it out because it was oil and it would have gone straight to the surface. We blew main ballast, which should never ever be done in a dive submarine. We blew number 6 main ballast, and that did alter us a little bit. Never cut the angle, but it stopped us going down, and we were there. We couldn't get up. So what we had to do was transfer that weight from aft to forward. Can't run the pump, couldn't pump it out because of the oil going to the top. You couldn't start the pump anyway because of the noise, and the Italians were particularly good at picking up sound. So we carried 600 gallons, I said it was 800, and I think 800 was the figure, of this oily water stuff from right aft up the slope forward and dumped it in the bilges right forward, you see. I suppose 200 gallons of it was spilt on the deck. So besides trying to pass a bucket from one hand to another on a slippery damn deck, oil and everything else, and holding on with one hand, it was a tremendous job. But we did it. And we reckon that we upset probably 200 gallons on the way through the boat, but the other 600 we dumped into the four bilges. And slowly we got back to an even keel. Well, we stayed there for quite a bit, and we could hear destroyers roaring over the top of us. And a few more depth charges came down, but nowhere near us. Whether that was because we were too deep, or they were off course, I don't know. I always thought that we were too deep for them. We were down about 400 feet, you see, which is something unheard of in those boats. However, I think it was about 4 hours later that we managed to get up to periscope depth and looked around the skipper, and they'd all gone. So we pumped out the bilges and everything else and got rid of them, but of course we could do nothing about the tank. So we had to run with 6 tons heavy, and not knowing quite what would happen. However, made report, I suppose, to the parent ship, and we were then sent up into the Adriatic. And on our way into the Adriatic, we passed an Italian destroyer in the Straits of Otranto, and I was on the bridge at the time, and I could have thrown a spud at it and hit it, coming down the other way. But the point was, it was so close, we were inside its turning circle, so it couldn't turn and ram us. It opened up with all its guns, but we got down, and we could hear the shrapnel rattling in the casing and stuff. But they knew we were on our way into the Adriatic then, and they were waiting for us. So we went up into the Adriatic, and I don't think we had a dull moment all the time up there. We I think the next thing that happened up there, we got rammed. Yeah, we got rammed by an Italian anti-submarine vessel of some sort. We didn't know how badly it was until we got back to harbour and into dock, and then we found that all our main ballast tanks were flattened on one side.
How did it happen?
It was a misty night, and it came out of the mist, and we couldn't do anything about it. It ran straight into us. Luckily for us, it wasn't doing much of a speed, somewhere around about 6 knots, I thought the captain said. However, it did a lot of damage. It damaged our hydroplane, forward hydroplane. However, being good sailors, we carried on, and we sunk a ship the next day. And again, we got hammered by 3 escort vessels.
What do you remember about the sinking of the merchant ship?
Well, that's a puzzle, really. There were two of them. There were two biggish 6,000 tonners coming out of a place called Durazzo. That's on the Yugoslavian coast. And we could have got the two, I reckon, but the captain, having wasted 5 torpedoes, I suppose, was going to be a bit careful. So we fired one fish at the leading ship at 3,000 yards range and hit it bang amidships, and as the captain reported to us, it was coming up bow and stern, meeting one another. And went down straight away, no problem. He said something about it was not too bad this time. There was only one escort. But suddenly 2 more appeared from the back of the other one, and they came and so we couldn't get a chance at the other one. We were too busy dodging these 3. They were pretty clever. One got either side of us. We were down at about 200 feet, I suppose. They got either side of us, and the other one ran backwards and forwards, dropping charges on us. You know, they could pick us up with the sound, you see. And they were pretty close. And we had rivet trouble, and a couple of rivets started to leak, and lights went out and stuff. However, we got away with that one all right. And I think it was the very next night, we were again attacked by two MAS vessels.
MAS?
Yes, I don't know what that means, really. They're called MAS. Anti-submarine, anyway. Something anti-submarine. And again, we were fortunate and got away with it. Then we fired two fish at a tanker, which was unescorted. Unfortunately, the tanker was empty and the fish went underneath it. So there was another two fish gone. And then on our way out, we got recalled after 22 days. On our way out, the forward hydroplane dropped off. The damage done by this thing that rammed us had fractured the axle of the forward hydroplane, and it dropped off. And yet we'd sunk a ship and done all sorts of things with it. Lucky can you get. So we had to go into Malta for repairs. This is what we did. And we were in Malta for 18 days, and that was an absolutely wonderful break. Mark you, it wasn't very peaceful. There were a lot of air raids going on.
Was this October 1940?
Yeah, October 40. Mm-hmm. I just got the Italian medal for that. Up there. A commemoration medal.
Yeah. Mm.
There's a Russian one there for the Russian convoys.
Yes, I recognise that.
And the Malta one, yeah.
Why was it so good in Malta?
Well, strange, isn't it? Because we had nothing to wear except what we stood up in. When you went to sea on patrol, you went in what we used to call running gear, you know, any old thing. So when we put in the Malta for repairs for a new set of hydroplanes, and to have the tanks all straightened out and the new wireless aerial and whatever had been done, we had just went ashore like tramps. But, the beer in Malta was lovely.
Was the bombing doing much damage?
Oh, yeah, but this was before the Germans, of course. Yeah. But they bombed from such a tremendous height, you know. Yeah. It was wonderful to see it. We lived ashore, obviously, and we used to go down the boat about 7:07 in the morning, and they were all coming out of the shelters, because it's very soft rock in Malta. I don't know if you've ever been to Malta. Very soft rock. It's very easy to dig it out and make air raid shelters. And all the people were coming out of the air raid shelters and going home at that time in the morning, all in dressing gowns and pyjamas and night dresses. Wonderful sight.
Were they in good spirits?
Yes. Yes, oh, I loved the Maltese people, and I thought they were tremendous. Yes, we left Malta after refitting and went on a third patrol there. Again, we had a boring patrol. We only saw one thing, and that was one night, a blaze of lights coming across the horizon from Italy, and it was a big hospital ship. And I was a bit horrified at this one because the skipper said to me, I got along very well with the captain. And he said, you know, Coxon, I got a damn good mind to sink it. And I was horrified. It was a hospital ship. I said, you can't sink a hospital ship. He said, but there's no troops on it. He said, it's going to North Africa. He says, it's full of ammunition and troops and what have you. I said, well, you don't know that, so do you? He said, no. All right. So he didn't. He made a signal and informed Malta that this hospital ship was on its way through. But I in those days, I think he's undoubtedly right, but I couldn't take that.
So you had a lot of influence with him?
Yes. Well, I was very good at my job. And when we left Malta, we were laying off in midstream. And a friend of mine who ran the base in Malta comes running over to the dockside, and he stuck his thumbs up like that which told me I was going home. I thought, and I'd been out 3 years. We didn't expect to come home, you know. Not that there was perhaps nobody to relieve us, but how were they going to get there? We were not indispensable, but we were very trained and men. So I was so delighted, I turned around to the captain and I said, I'm going home. And he just looked at me, he said, over my dead body, he said, you're not going home before I do, but I knew he didn't mean it. He said, well, how do you know? I said, oh, just got a message from Shaw. So I got back into Alexandria and, of course, left the boat. And as I say, the next thing I know, there were these Americans down there wanting to know. This was over a year before they came into the war, wasn't it?
Yes.
And that commander was going to sea in our submarines at that time, learning. They were very, very keen, very, very interested. So then, of course, I came home, and that was it.
Did you continue on active service once you got home?
Oh, yes. I was one of the very few who went right through the war in the submarine service. I mean, a lot went back to general service as being unfit. And I mean, when you lost a submarine, you lost the crew as well, and 9 times out of 10. I think when the war ended, there couldn't have been any more than 100 of the original submariners left. I know that in 1944 there was only 200, and we must have lost a few after that. Yeah, so I only had one moment, and that's when I finished that diary. I know I got back into Alexandria Harbour and I went to make it up. And I picked up my pen and I sat at my desk in the boat to make it up, saying I was leaving the boat and so on. And I couldn't write a letter. I looked at my hands and they were perfectly steady. And yet, I couldn't write a letter. It gets to you. And it got to me. Really got to me. It didn't last all that time. Eventually it was fine. But I tell you, since that day, my writing has never been as good.
What were you asked to do once you got back to Britain?
Well, I was due for 6 weeks' leave, but I only got 2 weeks and got recalled, and I was then told off to go to a submarine called, I think it was the Swordfish, certainly an S boat. The coxswain had gone sick, so I thought, well, just my luck, because I was expecting, hoping to go on another 2 weeks, you see, leave. However, it turned out that this coxswain wasn't so sick as he thought he was, and he had to go, so I went home on leave again. When I came back, I was back in Dolphin for about 2 or 3 weeks, I suppose. Then I got drafted to the Tribune. And I'd never been in a T-boat. They were the new boats at that time. And she was based up at Blythe. And the drafting colleague said to me, Frank, as far as I know, she's only doing training classes. So I said, oh, that'll suit me. So I'd gone up to Blythe and joined the Tribune. And she was doing training classes. My usual procedure when I joined a boat was to go right through just to see what made it tick and so on, you know. So I walked through the Tribune, and I got to the engine room. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was like going through Epping Forest. The engines were held down by big balks of timber. Between the deck head and the tops of the engines, holding them down on their beds. They'd broken away from their beds. Now, I'll tell you this story briefly, because I can't really vouch for it. But the Tribune was built in 1938, the year of Munich, built at Camilleres. And the engines were German. The diesel engines were German engines. We didn't make good diesel engines in those days. And they were being installed by the Germans. I think it was Mann and company. the Germans were installing. And then Munich happened. So they dropped everything and went back to Germany before the engines were installed, you see, over there. Well, when old Chamberlain came back with his bit of paper, back came the Germans and reinstalled the engines. Well, I'm pretty certain it's right. They were sabotaged. They weren't bolted to the keel strongly enough. There were a couple of bolts missing, or the threads were broken, or something happened. Because it wasn't very long afterwards when they broke away from their beds. It never happened before or since to a submarine, to my knowledge. So, however, they came back and they placed the engines, and the Tribune commissioned and went into service, and then before very long she broke up. And so I was on her doing training classes, taking training classes to sea, until such times as the PQ-17 convoy to Russia. And then we went on that one. And as you know about PQ-17, it's a horrible thing, but we were sent out early, and we went to, I think it was Alton Field in Norway, and Tirpitz and the Prince Eugen and other ships were based in Alton Field, which is just south of the Falkland Islands. So before the convoy sailed, we were sent over there to keep our eye on the fleet, German fleet coming out. And sure enough, out they came. Well, I had strong feelings on this one, because having been mixed up with the Italian battle fleet without a great deal of success, I certainly wasn't looking forward to getting mixed up with a German battle fleet. But I don't know anybody else that ever saw the two fleets, by the way. Remember, there's a double entrance there. You can come out of Alton Field and straight through into the North Sea, or they can turn starboard and go up inside the Leeds and come out the other way. And they went up that way and went out that way, so we weren't in a position to attack. But that is a surprising thing, because we couldn't transmit dived. We could receive dived, but we couldn't transmit. So we had to surface and make an enemy report that the German fleet had sailed. And there were German planes flying overhead. They knew we were there, all right. But they never attacked us. And I have a feeling about that. It might have applied in the German Navy, but it certainly didn't with us. When we came out of Lerwick to go on that patrol, we were attacked by one of our own aircraft. And we were, luckily for us, he never had any bombs. But we were shot up by his cannon fire, and he smashed all the wireless insulators on the aerials on the bridge. Put a bloody bullet through my steering wheel on the bridge. We proceeded. It didn't stop us going on patrol. And that happened in what we call the sanctuary. You ever heard of the sanctuary?
No.
Oh. Well, outside each harbour where submarines were based, there was an area of sea which was called the sanctuary, where submarines of any nationality, German or not, whether you knew or not, could not be attacked, because we'd been attacked by our own aircraft on several occasions. So it was made into a sanctuary. We were in the sanctuary when this happened at Lerwick. And I wondered whether the Germans had exactly the same principle, and they probably did, because there's a lot of U-boats up there, and they probably had a sanctuary as well. And we were in that sanctuary, so they didn't attack us. That's the only reason I can think of. However, we proceeded from there and acted as a screen to PQ-17, and the Tirpitz and Prince Eugen and the destroyers were out, and we were laying next door to a Russian submarine in the screen. We were about 15 miles apart, I suppose, about 8 submarines, screening the convoy from a land attack. And the Russian submarine, it was 15 miles from us, made a report that she'd hit the Tirpitz with 2 torpedoes. I didn't believe it. And how right I was. They never hit it at all. But the captain, a man named Coe, I was laying in the bunk and he came along and he said, shook me, he said, Coxon, he said, report from the Russian submarine. Now, the first time he shook me was to tell me that the Tirpitz and that were 16 miles away. So I said, all right, sir, and I was laying in my bunk. So he turned away and he came back. He said, ain't you going to get up then? So I said, no, not at the moment. So I'll be there whenever I'm required, I'll be there. But, I always regretted this. So he went away. And he came back again a few minutes later to tell me that the Russian submarine had hit it with two torpedoes. So I said, well, that's that. She won't come out now. We'll roll over to Ghostly. Oh, he said, that won't stop her. Oh, I said, not much it won't. It wasn't what Hitler said. If any danger to his battleship, he wants them back in harbour. And, of course, they never come. But what we didn't know, the Russian submarine never hit it at all. But that's in print. You can find that in books. Print. Yeah. So, yeah, so we got back from there, went back to Lerwick.
Did you know about the circumstances of the PQ-72 convoy?
We didn't know a lot about it. We knew the planes were coming over us thick and fast. It was done mostly by dive bombers. Oh, I'd say, well, dozens of them. You couldn't say hundreds. But dozens of them were going in, and they were only about 2,000 feet up. You could see the pilots in some of them. They never affected us. If you remember, it's broad daylight up there all the time, you see. There's no point in us diving. If we used to dive during the day and service at night and charge back, we might just as well stay up, which we did. So we knew that it was pretty hectic over the convoy, but they never bothered us. And then 13 out of the 33 ships were saved. 20 of them were sunk. And we then went back to Alton Field, hoping to catch the Tirpitz and U-boats or whatever, going back into the harbour. But we were there 3 or 4 days. A lot of activity ashore, and rockets were going up and everything else, but we never saw any sign of the ships. So from there, we went back to Lerwick, and we made first reserve for PQ-18, which, to my horror, upset me considerably, because my daughter was about to be born, and I was hoping to be home in Blyth for her birth, you see. We'd gone on PQ-18, that never happened. So I was on the conning tower, and the first lieutenant came up, and he said, you seem a bit quiet, Coxon. I said, yeah. And I said, first reserve. I said, well, you see that one over there? And it was a French submarine called the Minerve. I said, I'll bet you anything you like that falls over. And it did.
Falls over?
Well, you know, unfit to go to sea. However, the disaster of PQ-17 cancelled PQ-18. So I got home in time for the birth of my daughter. And went on PQ-18 afterwards. That was quite a different story completely. I think about the same number of ships in the convoy.